Thank you, Greg. Gavin.
Tom, thank you. I remember working with Jim Mather on the arbitration bill when it came through the Scottish Parliament a couple of years ago, and my favourite Jim Mather quote at the time was, which reminded me today when he said it, "There is no such thing as unintended consequences. There is only lazy thinking." And it strikes me that in the Scottish Government's approach to pensions so far, there are quite a number of unintended consequences. If we look firstly at the demographics, there is a demographic challenge in the United Kingdom, but there is a particular demographic challenge in Scotland greater than the rest of the United Kingdom. The number of Scots pensioners will increase by 80% between 2010 and 2060, with most of that increase concentrated between now and 2035. And as we heard on the Finance Committee from National Records of Scotland, the proportion of Scotland's population which is of pensionable age is projected to increase by 2.9 percentage points going to 2035, compared to 1.7 for the rest of the UK. That's quite a quite significant difference over a 20 or 30 year period. The estimates that we saw about the cost of the state pension in the expert working group report that came out last week acknowledged that they do not include in their estimates the diverging demographics between Scotland and the rest of the UK, and they state quite explicitly that if the two are to diverge, then the figures that they put up will have to be redone. I think it's difficult enough to continue providing what we currently have in terms of a state pension, but the Scottish Government continually will say that we'll get even more, things will be even better in the result of independence, and I think it's time for them to produce a credible and costed plan of how that might work. We do hear the statistic bandied about that actually we spend a lower proportion on welfare relative to GDP. For a word of caution there, whenever the government says that, it generally relates to the most recent set of GERS figures, which are 2011-2012. What is far more important is what will happen in 2016-17, 2017-18 and onwards. And as the Cabinet Secretary, Mr. Swinney, acknowledged again in that private paper that ended up in the public domain, by 2015-16, the position will have reversed. Scotland will be in a worse position financially relative to the rest of the UK. And in his paper again, he talks about how we will rely heavily on oil, which has a high degree of uncertainty and considerable volatility. Those are direct quotes from that paper. In Scotland too, we have a particular issue in relation to public sector pensions. We have a higher percentage of people employed within the public sector. On average, they have longer service. On average, they have lower salary, so those latter two factors may balance out. But even if they balance out, because of the higher numbers, we're going to have to pay greater amounts for public sector pensions in Scotland going forward. And again, the Scottish Government have been highly critical of changes at a UK level, saying that they wouldn't do such a thing, which means they're going to spend even more if they are true to their word. Let me just have one final point. In relation, again, to the working paper that came out last week, the administration and the complexity of the system between Scotland and the rest of the UK. The Scottish Government position as of yesterday was that it would be seamless. They believe that the working group demonstrate how seamless a transition that would be. But when you look at the working group's paper, they produce a matrix showing what the risks are. And on the best case scenario, on the preferred option, which is sharing services between governments, of the six most important factors, three of them are deemed to be low risk, but three of them are deemed to be medium risk, namely support, flexibility, and value for money. So the Scottish Government says it's seamless, but their own working group say that half the factors are medium risk, the other half being low risk.
And close.
So there are a huge number of issues to talk forward. I look forward to debating them over the next hour or so. And thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Some may argue that this is the lightning rod in the debate because it affects everybody that lives in the country who will all either be retired or one day are retired or will one day retire. ICAS has taken a position of public interest here in the debate. I know that some of you here may have a public interest. I think some of you may be conflicted, because with an independent Scotland and the amount of pension advice that will be required with the separation of pension schemes, some of you are smiling right across your faces. Hello, today we will be debating in the public interest, and we will maintain a debate around technical questions where it's appropriate, but also questions that I would hope and answers that I hope will be generated that the man in the street can understand. So if I could just say, I have several questions that I would like to ask the panel, but one very, very simple one, and I know it's been implicit in some of the statements that have been made already, but quite simply, for the man in the street, how will this be funded? That the state pension and public sector pensions in an independent Scotland. And I expect everybody to answer the questions. And I really would ask in the panel here, and I'm not trying to be overly simplistic, that it's not a case of it will all be okay or we don't negotiate on either side. I think we were looking for as candid answers as we can, notwithstanding the fact that it is a political debate. So how would it be funded? Gavin, if I start with you.
How would it be funded? I mean, trying to envisage a case where we do separate, there is going to have to be increased spending on pensions because of the demographics and because of various commitments implicit or explicitly made by the Scottish Government. How do you pay for that? I mean, ultimately, you either have to increase your tax take in order to pay for it, or cut spending on other services, or potentially a bit of both. I mean, basically, the Scottish Government rely, I think, heavily, were we to be independent, on oil revenues. The danger there is, do you project, or do you put your public finances on hinged on a best-case scenario on oil, which is, I think, the position at the moment? Are you a bit more realistic, and do you hinge it on a central scenario? Or do you take a more cautious approach in the long term, and anything you get additional through oil is a bonus, but actually being aware that it could be, you know, demonstrably worse than that, as the OBR predicted. But how do you pay for it? You're either going to have to increase tax or cut spending elsewhere.
John?
A number of points there, Anton. The first is the point that I made in my contribution, which is about the relative proportion of tax revenues that are anchored on paying for social protection, which is the catch-all public finance term for pensions expenditure. In the UK just now it's 42%, in Scotland it's 38%. So I think in terms of affordability, that demonstrates clearly that Scotland is in a position to afford its pension commitments. The second point I would make is in relation to the condition of the economy. Gavin is correct. Of course, oil becomes a factor in the economics of an independent Scotland and in the public finances of an independent Scotland. But it's not the only factor. We are the eighth richest nation in the OECD. That demonstrates to me an element of financial strength to enable us to deal with the requirements of paying for pensions and other aspects of public services. The third point I would raise is about the demographic issue. And the demographic issue is something that we either resign ourselves to and we just kind of accept that there will be a lower proportion of younger people in our society to pensioners, or we try to do something about that by creating a more stimulated economic environment in which young people are more inclined to remain in Scotland, economically active, rather than be essentially drawn out of Scotland to work in other jurisdictions, particularly in more vibrant economies in London and the South East. So there is an inextricable link between the economic prospects of Scotland and the way in which we can generate the economic opportunities within our country to create a larger, younger population, to encourage a more larger, younger population to be active here and contributing to the economy. So all of these factors come together as evidence of the sustainability of our pension system. And the point I would make about the comment about the affordability of pensions within Scotland, the position on differential social protection costs in Scotland isn't just some one-year figure. For the last 5 years, that has been the case, that Scotland has been a lower proportion of our tax revenue has been required to pay for social protection than has been the case in the rest of the United Kingdom. So I think we should put some of these points into the context that they deserve to be considered.
Thanks, John. Greg?
Yeah, thanks, Anton. I mean, to answer that question, I think we have to work out what are the things Separate Scotland would be paying for. So firstly, we would have to get the Yes campaign to put a price on the costs of replicating the UK regulatory architecture. That's something we need a price tag on. Secondly, there's the issue of the cost of fully funding cross-border schemes, which one would assume either there would be a proliferation of following Scotland leaving the UK, or there would be potentially a closure of schemes in Scotland. I raise again the currency risk issue. I mean, the Yes campaign assumes there will be a sterling zone. I don't think that can be assumed. And if Scotland does end up denominating its pensions in a different currency, well, the price tag just rises and rises. And I hear what John says about demographics, and I take it to mean that John accepts that Scotland's dependency ratio is going to be significantly higher on current projections. And that simply does raise a massive question for Scotland, not just in pensions, of course. I mean, it takes you into health spending as well. So I think these are the costs on top of just replicating the UK pension payments that John has committed himself to. So I think you would have to take what the UK spends in pensions, give Scotland a proportional share, and then try and put a price tag on all these added costs.
Thank you, Greg. Jim?
We've just had a presentation from David Bell that's told us Scotland's finances are stronger relative to the UK, and yet I'm in here just now listening to people who seem to be convinced that Scotland's involved in some kind of zero-sum game, traditional growth in population, ability to retain our young people would all be the same when we had our own sharp pencil, with our own policy, when we had our own ability to put in place feedback loops that we reacted to as a society to optimise Scotland. So I find that really fanciful. And I also listened to the talking down of oil and gas revenues at a time when $13 billion has been spent in the North Sea and west of Shetland, $13 billion in capital to give us a second oil and gas boom into the future. And also to find it somewhat ironic that we're sitting here in the Institute of Chartered Accountants event where we've just listened to Greg give us a dismal list of on-costs, etc., much of which we're already paying for already in one way or another. And it's always a repeat total failure to give us a true and fair view of what might be possible within Scotland. You know, so I like to try and look at the totality of it. I look forward to the day when we have a proper debate, where we have a situation where we look clinically at all the problems, and particularly at the problems in terms of the people that are impacted by state pensions, by the particular variants of the pension we've been discussing this morning, and then look to see how we try to optimise that based on the solutions there. But that requires everybody to be involved in the conversation and everyone keen to try and get a true and fair view.
Chair, can I come back on one point there?
No, not yet. No, good. We will open up, no disrespect, Gavin, there. But it's interesting to hear Jim end on an accounting point. You're at home here. But we would love numbers, ladies and gentlemen, wouldn't we? It's where we find a home, and there have been some numbers bandied around today, and I think it will be difficult to generate numbers, but there's one number that was interesting, £144 per week. Will Scottish pensioners get £144 per week, John?
Scottish pensioners will get the pension as we inherit it in April 2016.
Okay. Now, a question that we did ask, Scotland has a large number of public sector workers, retired public sector workers. Will they get at least the equivalent in an independent Scotland of their current arrangements? And this is a question I would ask to all panel members. Will public sector workers in an independent Scotland, do you believe, will they get the same, at least the same as the current arrangements? And Greg?
Very good question, Anton. I mean, I feel a little in this debate that we need to bring the arithmetic in. I mean, there's a lot of talk about rather vague, abstract notions and not much detail from the Yes campaign about actually the cost of all these aspects of pensions. And I would make the point gently to Jim that there's no question of Scotland not being able to decide its own future. The question is whether a separate Scotland, specifically in the pensions context, is in Scotland's interest, given that the UK system is built sustainable and has that population spread to pool risk. That is just a fact, and it's entirely legitimate to raise that as a question as we go forward in this debate. And I intend to keep to the detail of the pension system, because it was mentioned a number of times in the earlier session that the devil is in the detail in pensions. It must be about the detail.
And the answer is?
The answer is, who knows? We know that the public sector in Scotland is proportionately larger than in the UK as a whole. That raises, of course, an arithmetical question in itself in terms of price tag. That's up to John and his colleagues to provide an answer on.
Jim, do you have an answer?
I have every reason to believe that we'll start off from the same position and offer continuity and underpin it in that way. I was interested earlier on when David put up his slide saying only 21% of people would vote for independence if they were £500 less well off. The survey in December 2011 essentially said 47% would vote for it if they were level, and 66% if they were better off. So we have a strong motivation to keep people moving in the general direction of better off. And equally on the issue that Greg's now made twice of pooling risk, I much prefer minimising risk to pooling risk, especially when, as David pointed out, there can be moral hazards about, etc. We have a chance here in Scotland to have 5.25 million auditors auditing future governments of Scotland and keeping a really minimal risk and maximum upside.
Gavin?
I think in response to the question, I think it would be a lot more difficult to achieve, is my view, if we were to become independent for various factors. The higher proportion of public sector workers at the demographics that we've talked about, coupled with implicit promises from the Scottish Government in response to criticising the UK position, all of those together I think would be more expensive, and I hope the Scottish Government would accept that it would be more expensive and more difficult to do. The question then becomes how you do it, but I return to the point, saying that we would in a better financial position than the UK for 2011-12 is totally irrelevant to what happens in 2016-17, which is when it would happen. What matters is what we would have to spend then and what our income would be then. And again, the government acknowledged in their private paper that it wouldn't be quite so rosy then, and so there would therefore be huge challenges to achieve the same results.
Thank you. John?
First of all, Gavin raised the issue about the criticism of the Scottish Government about the UK's reform agenda. The thing that I've complained about the UK agenda is about an increase in employee contributions in 2012-13, 13-14 and 14-15, which has absolutely nothing, this is for public sector pensions, which has nothing to do with pension scheme sustainability or viability, but it's about deficit reduction. So it is a hidden tax that Gavin's government has applied to public sector pensioners across the country, and they've not had the honesty to tell people it's a tax. It's not strengthened the pensions position, it has simply added to deficit reduction. And you can explore that from the finance papers of the United Kingdom government. So that's what I've criticised, because I think if we're to say to pensioners that have been, for example, negotiating the sustainability of their pension schemes, and they have come to the conclusion of those negotiations and they all think they're contributing appropriately and the scheme is sustainable, you then turn up 12 months later and say, by the way, we want another contribution from you over the next 3 years to strengthen the pension scheme, when it's actually about deficit reduction. That is, to me, fundamentally dishonest. And that's what I've criticised about the UK government's pension reform agenda. So that's my first point. Second point is, you asked Anton about arithmetic. And let me, the arithmetic is published every year by the government, or I should say by statisticians. It's called Government Expenditure and Revenue in Scotland. It is an assessment across all aspects of public policy, not just the budget that I control, the 60% of public expenditure that I control on an annual basis, the 100% of what Scotland pays into the UK and what we get back in return. The most recent year for which that information is available showed that Scotland contributed 9.9% of UK revenue and we got back 9.3% of UK expenditure. So 9.9% in, 9.3% back out, which says to me, simply, arithmetically, we're contributing more to the UK than we're getting back in return. The difference between those two numbers, and it's a difference of £4.4 billion than if we had had our finances under our own control. So that is the relative fiscal strength in that financial year that Scotland has. And that's not a one-off. Over the previous 12 years, Scotland was contributing more to the UK than we were getting back in return. So arithmetically, the foundations of it are strong. Now, a lot has been made of the forward material that we have looked at. The numbers that Greg and Gavin talk about from the Cabinet paper that under my authorship did not take into account the investment in the North Sea that Jim's just talking about. The vast investment, £100 billion of investment in the North Sea, which fundamentally changes the outlook for the North Sea oil and gas assumptions within the paper. And I stress, we have a view that the economy of Scotland is about more than all of these factors. So I think there's, on the arithmetic of all of this, I think there is a very strong foundation for the argument that all of these provisions are entirely affordable, because that the 9.9, 9.3 that I'm talking about takes into account the cost of pensions.
Okay, thank you, Joe. I did.